by people telling, are giving thanks for the people who shaped their lives over the past years, and they're sort of sitting there thinking, should we leave? We really don't belong hearing.
That's not true. They're so happy to see you. Oh, it's hard. We lived up here one winter.
Oh, really?
It's very hard. Although we didn't have a troubled son, we're not clannish types,
uh-huh.
The two of us, but
we knew where we were going when we left.
Right,
that helps a lot.
A lot of them are going back to school, or they're going back to like their folks' place to stay for another month or two till they can get a job or whatever. You know, a lot of them are loose from college when they come here. But they got lectured. Ones that were staying got lectured on how to treat the guests when they come up in the summer, because we get such a little click
uh-huh.
on. We forget that the 400 or 300 guests that are up here, really, that's why we're here, you know.
Yeah.
And I didn't think that we had that particular problem, but maybe we did. I don't know. We just like to talk to everybody, and so we never had that trouble. But some of the younger kids really, really have trouble being nice to the guests, because they just, what are you doing up here bothering us?
We've got this, yeah. Well,
a good routine.
I understand the feeling, though, because where we are, of course, we've talked about where it is, and it gets very, very gray. And the most beautiful time of year is in the summer when the students are not there very much. And uh-huh. sometimes you really feel invaded in the fall when they all come rushing back, taking over your tranquil green lawns, you know. Thereby we're here.
They bring the money too, but they also bring all that new. Everything is new every
yes.
year.
It is wonderful. The institutional memory of a university is 4 years. You know,
that's really true.
Yep. Which is, has its advantages and disadvantages, depending on what it is you're trying to change.
Well, that's about the average tenure of a president, isn't it? University president.
4 years.
Well, I don't know. I don't know the figures on that. But, yeah, it's not lower than that. It may not be higher.
It may be 7, but still.
Right.
After he retired, he said he wasn't going to any faculty meetings because he wasn't making any of those decisions
well,
ever again.
I'm not going to tell them. Faculty or the administration what to do, unless, of course, they ask me.
Uh-huh.
Ask for his wisdom.
Flattery. I think we'll get started, and I'll try to start in a way that won't make it difficult to include anyone else that might come along. Earlier parts of this week, we dealt with Scripture and some of the contributions that Scripture might make to a Christian approach to ecology, understanding the earth as creation, and understanding ourselves as in one way specially appointed or gifted with the ability to direct the way that things go on earth, and at the same time, continuous with creation, part of it, and not completely separate from it or opposed to it. Tuesday we talked about some of the implications that might have for the way in which we understand animals. And yesterday we talked about poetry and spirituality of ecology, some possibilities in that direction. Today is probably the most abstract theological day, which probably is reflected in the size of our audience. Isn't it funny how that happens? What I want to talk about is how an ecological viewpoint is beginning to alter the way that Christians look at salvation history, at sin and redemption. How is it that we can imagine ourselves related to God and God related to us differently when we come from an ecological perspective? I'd like to start by just asking for a Christian account of God's relation to the world. What we had to draw maybe a timeline. What would be the events that we would put on it? What would be the critical events that we'd want to include?
What's the question again?
If we had to draw a map or a timeline or a diagram of God's relationship to the world and the important events that we would want to mark on that timeline or map or diagram, what would they be?
creation or something.
Okay. Okay. Just put that right there at the beginning.
Well, it was good.
Okay. So the good creation.
Mm-hmm.
What other events would we want to put on this timeline? We're talking about a timeline that would encompass the relationship, or a timeline or a diagram or something that would encompass the relationship between God and humanity and the important events in it.
Well, God had, you know, I guess I've read several books. God's had a relationship with man ever since creation.
Right.
Okay? So even prior to Christ, God has been attempting to have this relationship with all of his children. So at that point, there is this relationship. It's different than with one we have with Jesus, of course.
Okay.
Maybe it isn't different.
Okay.
I think Jesus does have a part in it because of, that's very theological.
Especially if we read John, right?
Right. But he's trying to have a relationship with all his human, his creation in some way, in a way that he had a relationship with the Indians, with people in New Guinea. There's all kinds of ways that God tried to have this relationship. And I don't know how you're going to put that up there.
Okay.
But he didn't just start with Jesus.
Right. So this is a story of God's relationship with our world. It starts with creation, and maybe people were created later, so we could put humanity on there.
But not separate from it.
No.
No.
Part of it.
What I liked, a fella told me one time, and it came from a Catholic background. He said, it makes no difference how man was created. Okay, at some point, God imparted a soul into people, humanity. So if evolution is your thing, that's okay. I don't believe that, but I believe God did the creation. But that's incidental to the creation of imparting a soul into humankind. But mm-hmm. at some point, God did that.
Okay? Right.
And how that happened prior to that time, I don't argue about that.
Right. So God creates the world and humanity, and that's kind of the beginning of God's relationship with the world and humanity, right? What other events in this relationship between God and humanity do we usually hear about that we would say, okay, then what happened in this relationship? What would be the, and then?
Well, Noah, the flood, and in the New Testament, talking about how God takes care of all that stuff, and then how much more will God take care of you?
Okay.
That's
so
way down there somewhere, because I don't know what you want in the middle.
Okay. Somewhere in here, we need to have some Jesus, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
All right. We're going to have to switch markers here in a minute. Okay, now I'm giving you a terribly big hint here. There might be some things that happened besides Noah and Jesus. What else in the history of God's relationship with the world do we remember from our Sunday school lessons, from
Moses.
Our theological?
Moses.
Okay.
What?
Moses.
Moses.
His relationship with his special people, I guess, okay.
Well,
yeah.
And who received
Moses?
No,
they were in the wilderness. There was
Abraham and Sarah, right?
Right, the whole Jewish thing.
Chosen people.
Yeah.
From here on, we have the history of the chosen people. Okay, Noah and the covenant. Anything else happened before Noah and the covenant? Thinking back to Genesis. That we often get told about in
the
history
of
God's relationship.
There was the Garden of the Ten.
Oh, right.
The people that were thrown out of it, and there's all that about whether the garden was the whole earth. Or...
Right. We are taught that start out with a good creation, God creates human beings, and then we have a fall.
And we have Noah in the covenant. We have Abraham and Sarah, the chosen people of Israel, Moses in the Exodus. Anything else happen in the middle here?
We got the prophets, the minor and major prophets and all that kind of stuff.
And why did the prophets come?
Well, people, we're still falling and coming back and falling and coming back. You know, we need to be reminded that God is the guy in charge and that we aren't in charge, and they just keep the cycle goes on and on. There's a cycle. People fall away, they come back, and they receive God, then they fall again, and it kind of goes around.
Right. So we have all these ups and downs in the middle here. It goes kind of like this.
Yeah.
Okay. With the prophets pulling the people back. And then we have Jesus, and this is Jesus' ministry. What happens before Jesus' ministry?
His birth.
Okay. All right. And we have Jesus' ministry. Anything else about Jesus?
Death and resurrection.
Okay.
But he ministered for a couple of years.
Right. I mean, this is actually pretty short. The Gospels make us think it was huge. But it was actually only about a tenth of his own life that he ministered, right, publicly, if that. We know historically. So, we have this little tiny period of Jesus' teachings. With death, resurrection, then what happens?
Ascension.
Okay.
And the church, you know, the church and Paul, we get the church starting with the disciples, and Paul does his thing.
Okay, the era of the church, right? Beginning with Paul and going on, and then what?
Beginning with Pentecost.
Well, beginning with Pentecost, right.
Right.
The coming of the Holy Spirit.
Yeah.
Okay, so, right, and Pentecost, highly underrated in the West. But really the most important feast of the church in many ways, right?
Right.
Okay, then we have the era of the church, then what happens?
The persecution starts.
Okay. I'm talking macroscopically, too. Okay, we're in this era in a sense. We have persecution. We also have domination, that is, by Christians. Persecution of, domination by. Anything come after the era of the church in which we are now? In your Sunday school learnings of salvation history, what comes after the era of the church?
Second coming.
Ah. And this is the period in which, depending on your emphasis, the sheep are divided from the goats, or the world is renewed, or whatever it is happens when Jesus comes again. We've been working a lot with the image of the tree of life in Revelations. Now, we could draw a kind of a qualitative map here. We want a topographical map or a cross-section. We started out pretty high here, right? Creation, humanity, then what happens when we get to the fall? Alright, then what do we do when we get to the next part? What would you say? Do we go along on the bottom? Do we come up a little? What do you think?
Yeah, we start to come back.
We come up a little at Noah.
Yeah,
maybe a little more at Abraham and Sarah. A little more at Moses and the Exodus. And then we're kind of going like this, right?
Right.
All right, now what?
I think so.
How high?
What, as high as you want to put it?
Depends on your theology.
Yeah.
Okay, depends on your theology. I probably shouldn't go up too much higher than that. Right? And then we, going on like this. Then, does it change or does it continue?
Well, I think we have the same kind of thing as what the Jews had. We're in and out, we're back and forth. You know, it kind of,
during the period of the church.
Right. During the period of the church, it's like
it's
this. We fall
wavy.
Away. Right, it's wavy.
Okay. And then in this century, we have some hard-thinking theologians who say that, well, they don't want to say really that everything's great, but they don't want it. But it's not as bad as it was. So they say it's already and not yet. So it's up here, but then it's also down here at the same time, right? Kind of like that. It's we're already saved, and yet we're not yet saved. And then at the second coming, we kind of meet these curves, and they go up higher than creation, right? Yes, no. Or equal?
Well, everything's very good at the end of creation. How much better can it get?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we should make it level?
I think equal. Because
equal?
It's a new creation. It's a new heaven and a new earth, and so we're back to it was good
okay.
when he did it. It was good when he started. It's good when he creates it the second time. And why?
It was perfect when he creates it the second time.
Well, it was perfect when he did it the first time.
Okay, so we have, it's at least equal at the end.
Sure.
So the history of God's relationship with creation is that it's good, it plummets, it comes back up a little, and Jesus arrives, and it's all the way up, mostly from there, except for these few little oscillations down here, which are the result of... Why do we still have those oscillations? See, the effect of this has not gone away. It's original sin.
Right.
Okay? And because of original sin, we're going to be going like that until the end, when that's completely erased. All right. This is sort of our Sunday school map of God's history of relationship with us. Now, what are some implications about God's connection to humanity, God's connection to the rest of creation, our connection to the rest of creation? For instance, how much of Earth's history does this get covered in detail here?
Oh, blip.
Right?
Yeah.
Not very much. Probably less than 10,000 years between what we would put here and where we are.
It's very anthropocentric.
It is.
It's a story of God's relationship with humanity, not with most of creation.
Right. I mean, you know, you get about, well, chapter 1 and part of chapter 2 of Genesis, okay? And a little bit of the prophets, but when God's messing around with creation and the prophets because of what we did, right? So we get this little, you know, 2 pages of God's relationship with the non-human creation. That's about it. Okay? So it's very anthropocentric. It's very centered on human beings. Now, that's not strange, because after all, we're human beings. Okay?
And we should be... Read the book.
Right! And we should be concerned about God's relationship with us. But if we want to know about God, there's a whole lot of time here that isn't on the map in any kind of detail. It's just sort of sketched in. Okay? Anything else that you notice about this?
Well, because of what you just said, I noticed the contrast between this and what might be a real map. A map of creation. I was reading someplace that if there were 10 volumes of books, the last word on the last page would be humanity. So I'm just contrasting that history of the earth with the history that we've written up here, in light of what you just pointed out.
Right.
The last word on the last page of the 10th volume.
Right. And God was busy all through those 10 volumes, right?
Loving it, and it was good.
Yeah. So we definitely have a focus on God's relationship with recent humanity. Now, humanity in the last 8 or 10,000 years is where we are here. Okay. What's the relationship between humanity and the rest of creation here?
Gosh, the rest of creation doesn't really exist too much in the map. It doesn't have any words related to it.
Nope.
It seems to be forgotten.
We're about to say something?
Well, we're part of it, but only part of it.
Right. We're only part of it. But at this point, we develop an adversarial relationship with it, right?
Uh-huh.
Okay?
We're supposed to work and till and provide our own food and do all that kind of good stuff.
Yeah. And the serpent will
strike
our God
for that, we blame creation for that.
Right. Right. Well, you know, you never want to blame your parents for the bad things that happen to you when you're at a certain age. You know, you want to blame somebody else, right? And you don't want to blame yourself either. So here it is. We have kind of an adversarial relationship with nature that doesn't continue all the way through the Old Testament. There's a lot of indication of symbiosis and mutuality, but there is this seed that has taken root in the Christian tradition from the first couple of chapters of Genesis, from the story of the fall, that we're in an adversarial relationship with creation. And so it is stuff that we're acting on and not sort of something alive that we're to be relating to. That means it's either a mechanism that's independent of us, and we got a little bit of that in the Gerard Manley Hopkins poem yesterday. Kind of, the Holy Spirit is the engine that keeps Earth going no matter what we do to it. Isn't that marvelous? We don't know that's not true, but there was that sense, even an optimistic vision of it in that way. Or it becomes kind of a substrate, something we draw on to nourish us, but that's the only way we think about it. You know. So we're not really part of creation. We're here in our bodies on the earth until we finally manage to escape our bodies. Right? At the end or at death. Okay? What's the center point of human history?
In terms of time or focus?
In terms of focus, here.
Jesus.
Right. You were about to say something.
Same
thing. Okay. Now, it really depends on who, on your church background, whether it's the incarnation, the teachings, the death, the resurrection, or maybe even the ascension that are important to you in the Jesus events of primary importance. That really depends on your church background and your theological bent. But Jesus is the crisis, the moment, the inbreaking of God in history. That is what we have all learned, that Jesus is the fulcrum, right? Right there, okay? Now, this may seem pretty obvious, but the reason that I'm emphasizing it is that it's not when we begin to look at this from a different perspective, okay? What happens to creation after this point? In our myth here.
In our...
But it's disturbed by man, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You mean prior to the fall or after the fall?
After the fall. It gets disturbed by us.
We have to work the soil, you know, we have to disturb it in order to survive, okay?
All right.
Got to plant the seeds and do all, you know, so we got to break up the environment and do something with it. So
creation isn't sort of continuing or getting better or anything like that after the fall.
It stays the same.
Right. It stays the same, or it gets a little worse if we bother it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not as though creation is just going on, you know, evolving, unfolding. Creation, this is it. It's done. Okay? And the only thing we can do to it is mess it up, and then God will come along at the end and fix it. Okay? But it doesn't get better or different, except worse, perhaps. Okay? What is salvation? Or what is sin?
Rejection of the Holy Spirit.
Okay. Rejection of the Holy Spirit, therefore rejection of God. Okay. By an individual.
Yep.
Okay. Anything else about sin?
About sin or salvation? About sin.
Either.
I think in a lot of just popular notions, salvation is the saving of individual people from sin for life after death with God.
Okay. So salvation becomes quite individual, right? You're saved from sin. This means, as I mentioned before, being taken out of your body this stuff. This is the body-spirit dualism, the matter-spirit dualism. Spirit is good, matter is bad. Get rid of matter. Leave your body, right? And leave its troubles and become spirit. And what you're being saved from are your individual errors, okay? Your rejection of God, which could be manifested in your rejection of other people or your cruelty to other people. But it is definitely an individual sort of thing. And the Reformation and medieval Roman Catholicism both helped us think this way because they were so focused on the status of an individual and whether the individual was going to heaven or not. Very important. Now, what is death in this system? Death good, bad, what does it mean?
Death is bad, and death is a result of evil or sin.
Okay.
Okay.
In other words, if it weren't for this, we'd be immortal, right?
Yeah.
Okay? And we probably would be vegetarians, too, but we'd be immortal. And so that's another important piece of this. Death is bad. Death is a punishment. Death is a sign of evil and sin. Okay? We have brought it on ourselves in a way. And the wonderful thing about salvation is that it's a release from death. This certain death that is imposed on us by God because of our sin, or that in some sense we've imposed on ourselves. Okay, you've all mentioned some things this doesn't do very well. It doesn't relate God to the rest of creation. Okay, that's one thing it doesn't do so well. This, the bigger the world gets, the trickier this is, right? The Jesus piece. Because it doesn't relate well to other traditions. It's very hard for us to put other religious traditions on the map here, other people who are not Christians. The best we've been able to do so far, I think, is in Orthodox Christianity. And by that I don't mean Greek and Russian Orthodox, but Christianity that doesn't get kicked out as heretics, is the idea that other people are kind of anonymous Christians. In other words, if they love the absolutes, if they behave well toward others, they're the kind of people who would immediately accept Jesus if Jesus were well presented to them, would immediately accept the gospel if the gospel were well presented to them. So we'll kind of say that they're adopted Christians. You know, we'll welcome them in as honorary Christians, and then we can include them. Okay, but that's about as far as we can go within the Orthodox traditions of Christianity, the mainstream traditions. So it doesn't relate God too well to the rest of creation. It doesn't help us relate well to the rest of creation. And it doesn't cover most of God's history.
It also doesn't do much. It doesn't address corporate sin.
Okay. I like to point out to my students that not only the Bible, but the theology that has formed our contemporary Western religious traditions, the theology that goes up through the 16th or 17th century, doesn't comprehend the person as a responsible social or political actor. Because society was arranged so hierarchically that the individual person had no right to affect, you know, corporate decisions, no ability to do so, and so it wasn't even worth talking about one's responsibility to do so. Okay? In a democratic society, we have to talk about our common decisions, our common behavior, our common value systems, and our responsibility for pushing those in a good direction. Whereas before, there was no possibility of doing it, and so that wasn't even on our list of jobs, of tasks to undertake. So corporate sin becomes a much bigger issue for us now because there's a possibility of altering the corporate behavior in a way that there might not, that people might not have perceived there was before. Okay? All right, now I'm going to erase all of this. And I'm going to talk a little bit about one, and I want to just stress one alternative way of viewing all of this. Many contemporary eco-theologians have picked up on what they're now calling a new creation myth. And their new creation myth, really their myth of cosmic history, comes from a book, was inspired by a book by Brian Swimmey. I don't know if you all know this. It's called The Universe Story. And actually, it's by, I think they wrote it together. Yeah, Thomas Berry and Brian Swimmey. It's called The Universe Story. And in it, I looked in the index. They don't even mention sin. But so they're not doing this as a self-consciously theological task. But theologians can get a lot out of it and have. In it, they're trying to tell the story with a more realistic timeline. Okay? Very, very interesting things happen when you start to do this. Images, it would be very difficult for them. We could put them on a timeline, and that's very instructive because, as Cindy just mentioned, you know, if you make this whole board the timeline, you would need to take a fine line pen and go all the way in the corner, and there we would be, right? And here would be the rest of God's work. Okay? But the images that they use are not so linear. They remind you of a flower opening. This is a terrible flower. I'm not very good at this. But a flower opening. Okay? Or maybe, especially with the Big Bang part of it, just something expanding and developing. Another way to picture that is as a kind of a spiral, ever-widening, changing, evolving into something new. These are the kinds of images that come to mind when you read this. They do have a chronological progression, and I think it's quite interesting, so I want to tell you a little bit about it. They begin not with God creating, well, even in Genesis, it's not really out of nothing, okay? They don't begin with God creating, picking up stuff and putting it together. They begin with the primordial flaring forth, or the Big Bang. And this is, $5 billion plus years ago. So we're really going back here, okay? Let me read a couple little bits so that you get a sense of what they're doing. Okay. The universe bloomed into existence, settled on its fundamental laws, and stabilized itself as baryons and simple nuclei. For several hundred thousand years, it expanded and cooled, and then in an instant at the very end of the fireball, the universe transformed itself into the primordial atoms of hydrogen and helium. Our wandering protons snapped into a new relationship with one of the erstwhile freely interacting electrons. These bonded relationships were impossible during the violent former eras, but now they became the predominant mode of reality. So you have that blooming of the universe. And he also says, let's see, he's talking about after the Big Bang, before we get to the next phase. In this phase transition, the fundamental architecture of the universe's interactions was set for all time. It was not yet certain where the largest stars would appear, but chemically, physically, the upper limits to their sizes and intensities were already fixed. It was not yet certain how many planets would come into existence, but an invisible ceiling for their highest mountains was already in place because of the strengths of the interaction.
reactions of the mountain's constituents was now in place. It was not at all certain if bivalve mollusks would ever exist, but the possibilities for shell sizes were now determined. It was certainly far from obvious whether or not there would ever exist anything like a mammal, but the fundamental range for how high they could leap or how powerfully they could clamp their jaws was now set into the sinews of the universe. Okay? So we have the primordial flaring forth with its possibilities, which begin to gel. Some doors close, right? The fundamental structures of possibilities, many of them never pursued, right, are now present in the universe. Okay? And then he goes on, they go on to galaxies, the formation of galaxies, the formation of supernovas, that is the collapsing stars that give off, even in their collapsing, gases that flare out and provide us with the possibilities for new kinds of formations. Let's see. And he says, they say here, violence and destruction are dimensions of the universe. They are present at every level of existence, the elemental, the geological, the organic, the human. Chaos and disruption characterize every era of the universe, whether we speak of the fireball, the galactic emergence, the later generations of stars, or the planet Earth. So we have violence and destruction built into the structure of the universe, and yet every destructive moment creates, okay, provides the material for a new possibility.
Christine?
Yeah.
Can you read that sentence again? Because it included, didn't it say chaos was also built into the universe?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. It does, and I'm not sure how they define chaos.
Uh-huh.
Is anyone here up on chaos theory?
No.
No? Because I think I remember hearing recently that chaos is not that chaotic. It's not random. But that's as far as I can go. Okay.
But it's also interesting the way, I'm sorry, but
go
the
ahead.
Way we see in so many of the Christian, our myth, the Hebrew Christian creation myth and others, that one of the fundamental functions of creation by the God is to bring order out of chaos. And so, anyway, it just struck me.
Yes. Yes, and they're saying, well, chaos is integral to creation. That without chaos, we wouldn't have life. Essentially, is what they're talking about here.
They also say violence and destruction are integral. And
yes.
We see salvation to some extent, but we see violence and destruction as a function of sin.
Right. Exactly. And here are violence and destruction at the heart of what we would call creation.
But also definitions of violence. And I mean, the human violence against human violence, human killing human, for instance, isn't built into creation. It's one has to define violence.
Well, that's changed. I mean, not human beings, but we think of the creation as change, that the changes are violent. The dying and rotting of trees and the killing of one animal against another. And I mean, all of the changes that are taking place, even on a little teeny microscopic kind of level, and all that stuff going on all the time. Motion, constant motion.
If our ideal is an organized, static structure, then this is horrifying, right? Because any change requires the demolition or alteration of what was there before. All right.
If that's
any
the definition
change.
Of violence, then we're in trouble.
Well, or if violence is bad and that's the definition of violence, we're in trouble. The question is here, is violence bad? Or is only a certain sort of violence bad? In other words, well, I'll leave that to you. But in any case, it turns out that life does organize itself, but is also breaking out of that organization constantly. All right? So we have life requiring what they call chaos,
violence. Okay. Then they go on to, I'm just going to go through these really quickly, the sun and the living earth. And it turns out because of gravity, radioactivity, and all sorts of things that only a planet of a certain size can congeal itself just enough to support life, but not so much that it becomes rigid and cools off, right? And it needs to be the right distance from a sun, right, etc. A good place for water cycle to happen so that it's the right temperature. Then we get, I'm not going to write them down because those of you who aren't biologists or paleontologists haven't heard of them, probably prokaryotes and eukaryotes, sort of something the level of virus and bacteria, and then real one-celled animals with genetic material sort of cordoned off within them, you know, in an organized place. All right. Then we get plants and animals. Okay. This is, you know, 570 million years ago. Okay, we start this era. So this is pretty, pretty long ago. Okay? Then we get human emergence. Primates start 70 million years ago, if you go with this vision of creation. And then 2.6 million years ago, we get Homo habilis. And then 1.5 million years ago, we get Homo erectus. Okay. Let's see. Homo sapiens. 200,000 years ago, okay? And if we want to talk about the modern human being, Cro-Magnon man and woman, notice how they always say man. That's 40,000 years ago, okay? So something that looks vaguely familiar to us, here we are, okay? Then he starts. Then they start introducing new categories really fast. They have the Neolithic age, and then they have classical civilizations. And then they have the rise of nations. Then they kind of, being cosmologists, you see, they overlay this with the period in which the history of cosmological study begins. And then they go on to epizoic. All right. Now, this is you know, early small villages, early agriculture, tool using, etc. Then we have Greeks, Romans, etc. All the way, he takes this all the way up almost to the Reformation, or about to the Reformation. And then we have rise of nations up to the middle of this century. And then the question is, will we enter the epizoic era? Okay. The epizoic era being the era in which we begin to understand our power in creation, okay, and to use it in a way that is symbiotic with the structures of life that we're facing now, rather than working against those. Okay. Anything striking about this picture?
I was wondering if anyone suggests how things would keep going if we weren't intervening. Does anyone suggest what it would keep looking like? Not necessarily humans, but how life would evolve? Or isn't that part of the question?
If people weren't around.
If we weren't destroying. If we weren't destroying what could come to pass.
With or without the humanity on Earth.
Here, with or without humanity's intervention. In the course of creation's ongoing history.
So if we just sort of went away?
Well, no, really, what if Homo sapiens had developed as a mutually contributing part of creation, as all the other species seems to have done. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering if anyone suggests how creation history would proceed, what animal life would look like, what humans would evolve into.
It sounds like she's almost saying how life would evolve without the original sin.
Well, I'll tell you, I heard a lecture, and this does relate to what you said about this Harvard guy who said that we're incidental. We're one little branch on one little tree of the whole creation evolution story. What's that guy's name? I can't remember. But anyway,
Wilson?
Pardon me?
Wilson?
No, it's not Wilson. I really am not trying to interrupt, but it just struck the incidentalness of humanity in this picture is so interesting.
It is, and even they can't resist having a whole bunch on humanity. You know, they're talking about trying to be realistic about this, and then a third of the book or a half of the book or something is on the history of humanity. One important point here, though, is that there have been mass extinctions many times in the history of our world. And the world, they suggest, becomes kind of chaotic for a while. It's sort of an evolutionary free-for-all. All kinds of weird animals and plants pop up until they see which ones of them work, you know, and then the ones that don't disappear and the ones that do stick around and continue to evolve. If we're looking at this cosmologically, there's no reason on Earth why we can't just go kill ourselves off, just like lots of other animals have. Other animals have gone beyond the limits of their ecosystems and died out or severely reduced their numbers. Other animals have been beset by quick changes in climate that they couldn't survive, perhaps in part to overgrazing or overeating or whatever. So it doesn't mean that we're not part of the cycle, too. If we're looking at it clear only cosmologically, yes.
The difference that I see is that as far as we know, none of them have taken the others with them. And that's the difference to me. We're taking it with us. If we're going out in the blaze of glory, they're all going with us. And that's the reason we're going out in the blaze of glory, is we're killing them all and everything else. I mean, you know, how dirty can you make the sea? How dirty can you make water? How dirty can you make the air? We play games trading off clean and dirty air. I mean, we play games with the airshed, which is the earth. So I don't, you know.
I don't see our right to pollute.
That's right. A new word to me, ecozoic. That's a wonderful word. It's really, it gives me hope.
And what we have that other animals over the course of world history and cosmic history have not had is self-consciousness, right? The ability to decide to behave in a different way consciously.
Wait, Bernard Wiener has a new book out, and we're not so sure about
that. Yeah, I'm not at all sure about that. I think there are others that are conscious, but maybe not to the point where they can read and write, but they certainly talk to each other. And they certainly say more than hi, how are you today?
Well, and Swimmy and Barry sort of imagine some sort of fish swimming around thinking, I think I'll try coming up there. Let's see what happens when I do that. that is, animals as experimenters, you know, pushing the limits and urging evolution on. But if we are aware that we're doing this, we have the possibility of altering our behavior. Whether or not other animals do, we in theory do have that possibility of altering our behavior to some degree. So we're an insignificant kind of piece of this, right? At least chronologically. Anything else? Well, how does that alter our image of God if we're just this period at the end of the sentence?
Well, the first thing that it strikes me is the obvious, that God has to do with all of it, not just us. Mm-hmm. But then I think about the timeline, we call it salvation history. Mm-hmm. And it does strike me that as I look at this or as I think about this, that salvation history may very well have to do with just us. because we're the only ones that need to be saved. I mean, it strikes me that there's a good reason God came as a human being, because the creation doesn't need redemption. Only humanity needs redemption from destroying creation. So it strikes me that maybe there's good reason to have salvation history be very anthropocentric.
Uh-huh.
We're the ones that need saving.
Right.
God didn't have to come as a fish, you know, because fish didn't need to be redone.
One could imagine the divine frustration over humanity being magnified by looking at this history. Darn it, it's been going just fine till now, you know. Then they had to come along and mess it up.
Well, it also seems to me to put a much heavier responsibility on us. Not just we individually have to do the right thing for our own personal salvation, but we corporately have to do the right thing for the sake of the whole creation.
Right, right. It emphasizes instead of our opposition to the rest of creation, our interdependence with it, right?
Mm-hmm.
We become very highly interdependent. We become very highly responsible for it. Is there a fall? A fall. A place where original sin begins. A place where humanity begins to go astray.
No, it knows it's now.
Well,
I don't know. You mean as far as God is concerned, or as far as
our
relationship to the creation?
Yeah. However you want to describe it. I mean, this kind of model makes early human beings pretty innocent. And then it makes human beings for a long time what we would call objectively wrong, but not morally bad, because they didn't know what they were doing. Right? It makes guilt be pretty recent. And this picture has falling, if you want, maybe being gradual and occurring not right at the beginning of human life, but fairly near now, at least ecologically, which is interesting because it changes our picture of this. And it makes the idea of original sin much more social, much more corporate, much more the idea that we all participate in a community which colludes to sin, right? Colludes to create injustice, colludes to despoil the environment. What is salvation then?
Joining with our environment for one, and not associating with the rest of the world for two.
Mm-hmm.
Action and reaction.
Mm-hmm. So it's the sort of the restoration of the appropriate relationship between us and the earth, the rest of the creation,
fellow beings,
and fellow beings, right? Okay.
I guess my relationship is with God, and if I have a right relationship with God, the right relationship that He wants with me, the other will follow. If
uh-huh.
I don't have a right relationship, the other's going to go away. So that's my relationship. Yeah, that's my first relationship.
Mm-hmm.
The other will be fine if I have that relationship.
What was the question? Salvation.
What is salvation art? What are the characteristics of salvation? Does salvation require us to leave the world and leave our bodies?
No, I'm back to, you know, I hate to be repetitious. It's a relationship with God.
Mm-hmm. Right one.
The right one. Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
That's it.
Yeah.
And that's it. Whether you by my spirit, my body, it's a
right.
relationship.
Right.
That I appreciate what He has created within me and within the world.
Right.
And have this relationship.
So it turns out it doesn't work very well if we make an utter dichotomy between individual salvation and the renewal of the earth, right? We can't say those are opposed to each other. But what we can say is if we follow this model of looking at God's relationship with the cosmos, salvation becomes something very much embodied, becomes something that has to do with the ongoing life of the cosmos. And not something that has to do with, oh good, we finally get to be released from the cosmos. oh good, we finally get to be released from our bodies and our earth. And that's a very different image. We also get the idea that this view of the world has linked up with what's called process theology, which some of you may know of. John Cobb, Marjorie Suchoki, and a bunch of other people are drawing on process theology to look at ecological issues. And the important thing, there are many important features of process theology, but the important thing for us here is that there's no such thing as the creation. Okay, there it's finished. Don't mess it up, please. Oh, if you mess it up, I'll have to come along one day and fix it. Okay? The creation is ongoing. Human beings are part of creation, and they influence the direction in which creation continues. Okay? The whole cosmos is an interacting system. And so we are co-creators, for better and for worse, because we are part of the system. We are making other things happen. All right? This also means that it's very difficult for people to see Jesus as the center of history, except in a very expansive way. Some people have described this as there being a transformative principle called Christ and Jesus being one manifestation of it. It's very difficult to do Christology here, and this isn't all worked out. It's hard sometimes to figure out how to put all of this together, so this is a work in progress. But it also is more expansive and inclusive of other religious traditions in many ways. What about death?
I like what somebody says. My father owns the land on both sides of the river, and that's it. Okay, that's, I like to look at it that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a river to go across, and if I truly believe what's in the Bible, that's what it is.
Right, so you're not envisioning death as the wages of sin, right? But as a natural part of our existence.
Well, sin exists,
right.
You know, but
right.
Because of my belief, I have a belief that that's going to carry me over the river.
Right.
It seems as though death is not the opposite of life, but is the opposite of birth. The birth and death both come in the stream of life and are natural parts of it and aren't a function of sin in the least bit.
Right.
But there are different kinds of death. And some kinds of death are a function of sin.
Right. If they're the result of unjust violence.
Yeah.
Right. For instance, the Rosemary Ruther and a number of other people are beginning to say, well, eating and being eaten aren't evil. It's how you go about them. And killing isn't necessarily evil. It's a matter of how you go about it. And she doesn't mean killing of other human beings. She's very much a pacifist. But a couple of little excerpts from her work. An ecological spirituality needs to be built on three premises. The transience of selves, the living interdependency of all things, and the value of the personal and communion. That's a very important piece of her. As we accept both the value and the transience of the self, we can also be awakened to a new sense of kinship with all other organisms. Like humans, the animals and plants are living centers of organic life who exist for a season. Then each of our roots shrivels, the organic structures that sustain our life fail, and we die. The cutting of a life center also means that our bodies disintegrate into organic matter to enter the cycle of decomposition and recomposition as other entities. Just like the supernovas. Okay. The dialogue can become truncated. We can seek to grasp our ego centers of being in negation of others, proliferating our existence by diminishing that of others, and finally poisoning the wellspring of life, of the life process itself. Or, ecozoism, we can dance gracefully with our fellow beings, spinning out our creative work in such a way as to affirm theirs and they ours as well. Then, like bread tossed on the water, we can be confident that our creative work will be nourishing to the community of life, even as we relinquish our small self back into the great self. Our final gesture as we surrender ourselves into the matrix of life can then become a prayer of ultimate trust. Mother, into your hands I commend my spirit. Use me as you will in your infinite creativity. So that death is part of the process of life. And lest we think this is a new idea, I want to point you back, this is the last thing, to St. Augustine. Talks about, so what, this is kind of a perverse meditation, but there's a point to it. What happens if you hang somebody upside down, is basically what he's asking. And they die, right? Okay. There is for a time a kind of tumult in the corpse of exhalations disagreeable and offensive to our senses, for that is what we smell in putrefaction, which lasts until the body unites with the elements of the world as little by little and particle by particle it vanishes into their peace. Nevertheless, nothing is in any way removed in this process from the control of the laws of the supreme creator and ruler who directs the peace of the whole scheme of things. For although minute animals are produced in the corpse of the larger animal, those little bodies, each and all of them by the same law of their creator, are subservient to their little souls and the peace that preserves their lives. And even if the flesh of dead animals is devoured by other animals, in whatever direction it is taken, with whatever substances it is united, into whatever substances it is converted and transformed, it still finds itself subject to the same laws which are diffused throughout the whole of matter for the preservation of every mortal species, establishing peace by a harmony of congruous elements.
Where is that in Augustine?
That is, I can give you, I think I took the whole site in here.
I could have said that westwards.
You could have, but you know, this is probably, I probably got it out of an archaic translation too. It's City of God, chapter 12.
City of God, chapter
12. Oh, no, wait a minute. Book 19, chapter 12. Uh-huh. Sorry. Whatever sin, whatever injustice we create in the structure of the world, we cannot escape from the fact that the world's natural processes, its chemical and biological processes, are going to go to work on what we do. If we have this copper mine out here, it's going to spit out water with a pH of 1 or 2, and we're going to have to line the channel with limestone, right? Or else it's going to burn holes in everything. And that structure, that atomic, chemical, physical, biological set of structures are the limits within which we have to work. And when we create ecological or social injustice, those kinds of factors are going to come around and bite us again. Okay? That's the message. I hope this is at least a way to start thinking about ecological issues and their effect on theology. I made a pedagogically very bad handout because I wrote on it some ruminations that I wanted you to tell me. So now I'm going to hand it out. And I apologize that I left, for some reason, plants and animals off the Thomas Berry and Brian Swimmy list, but I think you can figure out where they go. So thanks so much for coming and for your thoughts on all of this.
Thank you.